Welcome to New World Notes, edited by yours truly, Kenneth Doust.
Today, a special treat. Parts of a conversation I had on September 9 with singer, songwriter, and all-around great guy David Rovics. Journalist Dar Jamail will be in Connecticut, speaking many times between September 19 and 21. And David Rovics will be joining him in Middletown on the evening of September 21. We'll have details on all this at the end of the show. Before that, we'll hear my conversation with Rovics and two or three songs by him and a bit of my own reflections. In our conversation, David elaborated on two themes that are central to his music, community and capitalism. Without further ado,
I was going to start on place, and I understand you grew up in Wilton, Connecticut.
I did.
Wilton's sort of a almost off the radar screen to us east of the river, central Connecticut types. Yeah, I know it's in Fairfield County, and it's not quite as ritzy as Greenwich, and it's not quite as modest as Bridgeport. And I'm thinking of your fellow...
Way closer to Greenwich than to Bridgeport okay. In terms of finances and demographics.
I'm thinking of your fellow Connecticut good person, Ralph Nader, who grew up in Winsted and has written lately about the influence his childhood in a small town in Connecticut had on the sort of person he turned out to be. I was wondering if you had any experience like that involving a very different town, of course, Wilton.
I think it was something along the lines of learning how life works in a community where people work hard and are fair-minded and this sort of thing
and
wanting to pursue that.
His book was titled The 17 Traditions, and he found them all in his family.
Oh, great, yeah.
But Wilton is not Wilton the place where they were going to produce My Name is Rachel Corey, and then that got canceled at the last minute?
Here the interviewer makes his second dumb mistake within the first 2 minutes, the first being misplacing his notes. The play that we now talk about is not My Name is Rachel Corey, but rather Voices of Conflict. Similar in structure, but no cigar.
It was done by high school students in Wilton. It got canceled by the principal, and Ira Levin wrote a letter to the New York Times afterwards. I don't usually read it, but I happened to see this issue, and he said, sort of like that figures, I grew up in Wilton too, and I made Wilton my model for the Stepford Wives. And then the play went on to London and was a big hit, of course.
I think growing up in Wilton, I mean, I was always pretty down on it as a kid because I came out of a more, my parents are pretty alternative in terms of their thinking and to some extent, for sure, in terms of their lifestyle and their politics. And then I was, from an early age, pretty influenced by the whole hippie thing and then by anti-nuclear movement and other things that were going on when I was a kid. Not that these things were particularly happening in Wilton to any large extent, but I was influenced by these things, and so I kind of thought of Wilton as being a town full of sort of Republican Neanderthal. But I think certainly, there's other aspects to it that were just, if the whole country could be run in a more sort of fair-minded kind of way, like the way small towns tend to be, that would be better. But I think my association with Wilton is, I think where Nader grew up, it might be a bit different because that town, like Winsted, is kind of its own place and it's kind of too far from
Connecticut. Right. It's in north central Connecticut. It's not adjacent to Westchester County, New York.
Whereas Wilton is essentially, since I was young anyway, not before then, but certainly since I was young, it is solidly a New York City suburb.
Mm-hmm.
My impressions of it growing up was that it really lacks community, and it's a very expensive place to live. It wasn't as expensive when my family moved there, but it's become a very expensive place to live in, the sort of place where people buy a house there if they've got a good job in New York City, and then if they lose that job or they get transferred or whatever, they move, and there's a lot of real transience in the community, even though it's loaded with money. And everybody gets up in the morning and takes the train or drives to New York City and comes back in the evening, and that's pretty much their lives.
Community seems to be a really important theme in your work, doesn't it? Your song The Commons, or this was another Connecticut town, wasn't it? There used to be a city in this town. What was that? Was that Winsted? Was that Bridgeport?
I was thinking of Danbury.
Danbury.
Which is where my dad lived for many years. He was right next door. Norda Danbury, now in Bethel, but Danbury was for many years pretty much the world's capital of hat making.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, everybody used to wear hats. Now that's not the case, so, you know. I don't know where Stetson's operations are now, but, you know, I'm sure that they're somewhere overseas and, probably a lot smaller than they used to be because, of course, you know, as everybody knows from looking at any photograph from the 1930s or 1940s or the 50s even,
mm-hmm.
everybody had a hat. So, you know, it was a big business, you know. Then Kennedy started going around in public without a hat on and that kind of, you know,
and that was the end of Danbury. that in the Walmart.
So Kennedy killed Danbury.
I was young once, it was a long time ago. Things were different than I thought you should know. This old building was once a factory. We made Stetsons, your grandpa and me. It wasn't easy, but at least life was going down. There used to be a city in this town. This rusted rail yard had a hotel and a couple of stores. We had good times here between the wars. It wasn't paradise, but there was music in the street. Right there's where your grandparents first had a chance to meet. They got married in that church. I can still see her wedding gown. There used to be a city in this town. When the change came, it started one by one. First the layoffs, then the factory was gone. Then came the highways, suburbs and Walmart. That was the final blow that tore this place apart. But it seems like just last year, when there were people all around, there used to be a city in this town. Census says there's people here, but I think someone's confused. Just look out at these sidewalks, they're not being used. You know when a city dies, it doesn't die with grace. Just becomes a ruin, shouting this was once the place. I guess it's time to leave, but I don't know where I'd be bound. There used to be a city in this town. Used to be a city in this town. Used to be a city in this town. Used to be a city in this town.
I mean, a community is definitely real central to what I think is important, you know, and mm-hmm. certainly makes its way into lots of my songs.
Yes. Can you talk some more about that? About how and why you latched on to community as something that is really so important to what the world needs.
I think that actually had a lot to do with growing up in Wilton. I mean, for lots of people in the U.S., perhaps in the rest of the world, you know, people look back to the best years of their life and they think of high school, or if they went to university, they think of university.
Mm-hmm.
And they think, oh, that was the best. Why do people so often, and this is not just, this is not just every once in a while. I'd say most people probably look back to either high school or university as the best years of their life, even though at the time, they would probably have, you know, said that they were having a hard time with all kinds of things and felt really restricted and, you know, stifled in so many ways and all kinds of other issues. But then looking back on it, they say it was so great. The reason why they say that is because that was the last time that for most people, that's the last time that they had any kind of a cohesive community. No matter how dysfunctional it was,
uh-huh, sure.
it was much better, uh-huh. It was more of a community than the office. or the other kind of workplace that they find themselves in throughout most of their adult lives.
Mm-hmm.
So, as for me, growing up in Wilton, there was very little community in terms of people that I could identify with. And so I longed for community that I, for most of my growing up, didn't entirely realize whether it actually existed. But I suspected that the kind of people that I needed to meet and wanted to, you know, learn from and live with and all that were probably somewhere out there. And I didn't know where. As soon as I moved to a city, I found them. I mean, it's not that they're not hard to find. You'll find them in any major city. You know, leftists, you know, musicians,
right.
You know, people who smoke dope, and you know, whatever. You know, people who lived in a way that I could identify with as a teenager living in a town where I couldn't identify with just about anyone. So I guess community was important to me because I experienced it to some extent, mainly at camp as a kid, and I experienced the lack of it very acutely, and I think as a result I'm familiar, just as so many people are familiar, with the really tremendous emotional burden of living without community.
Mm-hmm.
People kill themselves all the time because of that. It's like, when you get down to it, you know, that's really why people are unhappy, is because they lack community.
Mm-hmm.
And what makes people happy is when they have community. Obviously, there's other things like clean air, clean water, having three meals a day. But quite recently, these psychologists at the University of Michigan were doing these studies on happiness around the world, and they found that happiness is essentially about having a healthy, functional society, a community, a culture. It's about culture and community. It's not about money, you know,
mm-hmm.
except to the extent that people who are starving are not happy. But once you have the basics taken care of, then it's all about community. I mean, what they found in this study was that the happiest people in the world overall are Latin Americans from throughout Latin America.
Ah.
And why is that? Well, of course, I mean, it's because of what they said in the study is because of their culture. Because of the Latin Americans who are not starving, who are, you know, getting by, not being persecuted and this sort of thing, generally they're happier. But, you know, their culture is born out of community. And anybody who's been to Latin America, anywhere in Latin America, pretty much, you know,
mm-hmm.
you see that so immediately. There's community. People live in communities where they know their neighbors, and their neighbors are their friends and partners, and they work together and they raise each other's kids, and it's just a much healthier model for society than the nuclear family suburb kind of place where I grew up,
mm-hmm.
and where most Americans live. I mean, I think the nuclear family in the suburb is the number one cause of depression in the world, and certainly in the United States.
Would you go so far as to say that you suspect the powers that be, the capitalist greed heads, have done everything they can to destroy community in America, to improve profits? If you're restless and dissatisfied, depressed, maybe you'll buy a bigger television set than you would otherwise. Is that too simple?
I mean, I'm sure that it's entirely possible that there are people within the ranks of the powers that be who are totally consciously promoting this process in order to destroy community and make people into, you know, little yes men and women and robotic and unquestioning. And it's entirely possible. But what is very clear is that the motivating factors in the capitalist system have nothing to do with promoting the health of a society, the health of people's minds or bodies, or the health of the planet. The
mm-hmm.
capitalism actually doesn't have anything to do with any of those things. It's all about making money. And it turns out that the processes involved with making lots of money and making money being central to how society functions actually turns out to be antithetical to all of those good things. Actually, capitalism, whether or not it's designed to do that, the overall effect of it is that it destroys community and destroys people's physical and mental health and destroys the planet. And ultimately, and also, it fails to take care of the very basic needs of most of the planet's population. So,
mm-hmm.
I mean, capitalism is almost completely worthless system. But, you know, there's some things that I think we can get out of, you know, the concepts of supply and demand and the market. It's not that it's all completely worthless, but overall, it's been just a disaster in so many ways, and we absolutely have to do far better. But I think, you know, certainly the people who continue to promote the kind of society we have and continue to make it more like that, you know, in all kinds of bad ways. More suburbs, more malls, privatizing more institutions, exporting more jobs, promoting the sales of more cars, more highways, so everybody's stuck in their little bubbles and don't know their neighbors and they're driving half their lives. You know, the people who are promoting these things, they're actively promoting these things and actively profiting off of this. To varying degrees, many of them are aware that there's really fundamental things wrong with the society that they're very much part of promoting. But at the same time, I think what rules more than evil, what runs these people is cynicism. Knowing that if they don't build this development outside of this nice little college town or whatever, somebody else is going to ruin that forest land and build some ugly development and make, you know, another suburb where everybody's going to spend half their time driving. It's the cynicism, I think, is really more the operative thing than you know, any scheming evil geniuses, you know, trying to make the world this disaster that it is.
Here Rovix has a good insight, I think. There are truly evil people in the world. Richard Cheney, Henry Kissinger, and Ariel Sharon come to mind. But evil people are well outnumbered by people who are basically good. Evil triumphs because too many of the basically good, or at least moderately good people, are also cynics. Since cynicism always makes more money than altruism, and since our entire economic system values making money even above species preservation, we see the effects of cynicism and its grandfather evil everywhere. Well, if you define the problem as of cynicism rather than as of evildoers, as W used to call everybody, you're closer to solving the problem. Or maybe the problem isn't even cynicism among capitalism's lower echelons, but just an insane disconnect between what you are rewarded for, increasing profits to the owners, and what you, your family, your community, your country, and your planet really need. So, two themes that appear over and over in Rovix's music. Community, and that great destroyer of community, the American style of capitalism, with its love of money profit above all other virtues, and its cynicism. It was our official state religion, which is neoliberal capitalism, that gravely damaged the communities of Danbury and of Wilton. But there's lots of white people in Danbury, and lots of rich white people in Wilton. When a community is chock full of poor people and people of color, American-style capitalism feels it can rampage more freely. Take New Orleans. And they did. Like political scientist Michael Parenti, Rovix has understood that black New Orleans was not destroyed by Hurricane Katrina. In fact, the hurricane itself barely touched the place. It wasn't killed by benign neglect or natural disaster, or the incompetence of FEMA. It was killed by cynically building shopping malls and luxury homes on the ecologically critical floodplain and other wetlands. By cynical gazing at all that prime riverfront property, now trod and even owned by black feet. It was killed by an economic system that worships one god, whose name is Mammon. August 30 was the fourth anniversary of privatized, white, developer-friendly New Orleans. You had to kill a few colored to pull it off, folks. But, as W said to Brownie, heck of a job, boys. Hoyt on New Orleans, Morgan Evelt.
Everybody knew that it could happen. The likelihood was clear, the future was coming. Now it's here. They had to fix the levees, cause otherwise they'd break. On one side was the city, above it was the lake. It was in the daily papers, in bold letters was the writ. What would happen when the big one hit? But every year they cut the funding, just a little more, so they could give it to the army to fight their oil war. National Geographic and the Times Picayune, they forecast the apocalypse, said it was coming soon. Preparations must be made, they said, now is the time. It was years ago, they shouted, inaction was a crime. They said the dikes must be improved and the wetlands must be saved. But Washington decided instead they should be paved, 'cause malls were more important than people's lives. So put some gold dust in your eyes and hope no storm arrives. New Orleans, New Orleans, New Orleans. Years and years of warning, no evacuation plan. It was just that the waters rose. Get out if you can. There were no buses, no one chartered any trains. There was no plan to rescue all of those who would remain. All the people with no money, all the people with no wheels, all of those who couldn't hotwire what that they could steal. Thousands and thousands of people abandoned by the state, abandoned by their country, just left to meet their fate. New Orleans, New Orleans, New Orleans. When people shouted from their houses, dying on their roofs. When people came to find them, they were turned back by the troops. They died there with no water, they died there in the heat. They were shot down by the soldiers for trying to find some food. Richest country on the earth, where the color of your skin determines what your life is worth, where oil is the king, where global warming is ignored, where the very end of life is the place we're heading towards, where it's more than just a metaphor, the flooding of the dike. And if we don't stop this madness, the whole world will be like New Orleans.
David's song New Orleans has the line, "But malls were more important than people's lives," which inevitably, if briefly, brings us back to Danbury. This town's best-known feature is what everybody calls the Danbury Mall, one of the largest upscale shopping malls in the Northeast. On the dirt on which it sits used to be an institution much closer to the community. It was the fairgrounds. There's an archaic word. The Danbury Fair, a rural site where each year they held the local agricultural fair. Later the farmers were joined by the hat makers. There were exhibits, pie-eating contests, sales of stuff by vendors, live music, pony rides for the city dwellers. The Danbury Fair began in 1821 and ended in 1981. In its last year, 400,000 people attended during the 10 days the fair was in session. In 1982, the land was sold to a developer, and the mall was planned and built, and it opened in 1986. The developer wasn't evil, he just had a family to support and send through Yale. And surely he or she figured that a nice mall with a Macy's and a Lord & Taylor was much better for the community than a hog feedlot, say, would be, or a string of 25 car dealers, transmission repair shops, massage parlors, Burger Kings, tanning parlors, and Methodist churches would be. To the people's credit, everyone calls the principal local attraction the Danbury Mall. The official name of the joint is, quote, Danbury Fair, unquote. Only the owners had the stomach to call them all that. Now there's some hopeful news out of Southwest Danbury, and it involves music. As I said, the old Danbury Fair not only had food, it had music, as all county fairs and state fairs still do. It also had huge 40-foot fiberglass statues, including what is claimed to be the largest statue of Uncle Sam in the world. It had a similarly sized statue of Paul Bunyan. According to reports, Paul now sports a tie-dyed t-shirt, and I presume a scarf. Known as the Hippie Muffler Man, he now lives not too far away, in Bethel, New York. Some reports say he is in front of a fish store. Some claim to have seen him at Max Yasker's farm in Bethel. Yes, the scene of the incomparable Woodstock Festival and reunions thereof. I suspect both reports are true. Why shouldn't the local fishmonger lend fiberglass Paul to Max for the occasional Woodstock reunion? There was music at the Danbury Fair, and the speaker in David Rubick's song says, of Danbury, it wasn't paradise, but there was music in the streets. Anyway, I find it reassuring that Paul Bunyan has moved from the music-filled Danbury Fair to Woodstock and changed into a tie-dyed t-shirt to show his approval. I didn't ask if Mr. Rovix of the Stetson Company, the supposed speaker of There Used to Be a City in This Town, also made music. But his son David sure does.
Did you strike a blow against the empire?
Unembedded journalist Dar Jamail, author of the award-winning book Beyond the Green Zone and the new The Will to Resist, will appear in Central Connecticut September 19 through 21. Dar will discuss America's wars in the Middle East. Hear Dar Jamail speak in Hartford's Bushnell Park during the Hope Out Loud Festival, Sunday, September 20. The festival runs from noon to 5 p.m. Dar delivers the keynote speech at 2:30. Then at 7:30 Sunday, join him in stores at UConn's Dodd Center to celebrate independent media and community radio stations. On Monday, September 21, at 7:30 p.m., Dar shares the stage with unembedded singer-songwriter David Rovix at Wesleyan University in Middletown. All events are free and open to the public. For more information, including details of Dar's other appearances nearby, see willtoresistwar.blogspot.com. That's willtoresistwar.blogspot.com. Dar Jamail's Connecticut tour is sponsored by many nonprofit grassroots community organizations working together. And let me supplement that PSA. Jamail's appearances include also talks and or screening of his films at Wrench in the Works and ECSU, both of them in Willimantic, and at CCSU in New Britain. The dynamic duo at Wesleyan on September 21, Dar Jamail and David Rovix too, is scheduled for Memorial Chapel, 221 High Street, Middletown. Again, beginning at 7:30, pretty please check the website for more info and any last-minute changes. Once again, that's willtoresistwar.blogspot.com. Here's one not listed there. Thursday, September 17 at noon on WWUH 91.3 FM, the show Soapbox will feature an interview of Dar Jamail by host Rob Terka. Soapbox, Thursday the 17th at noon, WWUH 91.3. If you're out of range, you can hear it streaming online at wwuh.org. Thanks to David Rovix for, among many other things, the long, long interview we had by phone a few days ago. I'll broadcast other parts of it at a later date. The opinions expressed in New World Notes represent the views only of two brilliant bearded white males and nobody else even remotely connected with this station. Check out newworldnotes.blogspot.com for all things New World Notesy. Illegitimi non carborundum, and look me up and say hi this weekend.
When it all comes crashing down.